Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Zeska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, May 1, 2019, and this is the Bob Zeska Show, interviews from Earth One, brought to you today by ProFlowers.com, promo code B-O-B-C. My guest today is the great Sarah Kendzior, Russia expert and co-host of the Gaslit Nation podcast with Andrea Chalupa, who, by the way, we spoke with 2 weeks ago on this show. Patreon.com/Gaslit, links in the description below. Today we're going to talk about the Mueller report and especially the letter Mueller wrote to Bill Barr that dropped in the Washington Post yesterday. By the way, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting this show at BobZeskaShow.com. And don't forget to give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. Thank you. And now here comes my conversation with Sarah Kendzior.
Hello,
Sarah. It's Bob Zeska. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great, great. I know this is a terrible, terrible time to be talking. During the Barr testimony.
Every time is a terrible time.
Yeah, there's no break, is there? It's just constantly 24 hours, the fire hose of news, as we like to call it. I mean, how do you get anything done? How do you deal with this? I mean, I'm speaking not you, just not the royal you, but you personally. I mean, how are you coping with this ongoing barrage, the bombardment with all of this crap dropping 24/7?
I mean, it's irritating. It's this weird combination of chaos and inertia because there's this constant change and all these little developments and all these things that people are saying or testifying, but the broader picture, unfortunately, doesn't really change. This consolidation of autocracy by the administration, the erosion of law, like that's the constant drumbeat that's going on as all these little scandals erupt and Trump tries to run out the clock. So that's what I try to keep an eye on.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you do to get your mind off of things? How are you offering yourself self-therapy in some sense?
Oh, well, I've got 2 kids, so I don't talk about, Trump and organized crime and the death of democracy with them. I think something else to do. So
you're not like delivering information about Uzbekistan to your children as you drive them to soccer practice or something, right?
I actually do. They know a lot more about Uzbekistan than the average child. But, you know, the good stuff, the fun stuff.
That's right. Well, you wrote your dissertation about Uzbekistan. I just want to make that entirely clear, that it's just not something random that you bring up, that you actually have a lot of expertise in that area, right?
Yeah. I wrote my dissertation about how exiles from Uzbekistan, you know, which is an authoritarian state in post-Soviet Central Asia, how they used the internet in the 2000s to try to battle their then dictator, Islam Karimov, and wrote basically about the dark side of the internet, about the way that dictators can use the internet for surveillance, you know, for propaganda, to disrupt, you know, civil society, to impersonate people, to release their information to the public, all the things that Russia has also done and that the Trump administration and the Trump campaign have been doing. So, you know, when Trump emerged in 2016, it was very familiar to me. And I actually wrote an article in, I think, February 2016, saying that Trump would probably win, and if he won, he would rule like a Central Asian autocrat. I think the article is called Trump Minbashi, you know, and not to Turkmenbashi, who's the ruler of Turkmenistan. So yeah, that's not what I expected to be using my dissertation for, but that is what's happened. So,
Let me ask you this, Sarah. I mean, along those lines, did you see the Russian attack coming before it really hit the ground? I guess my view of the entire thing has to do with the fact that Russia not only engaged in this attack, this invasion, but it had unwitting foot soldiers on the ground inside the United States. So, one, did you see it coming? And two, in Uzbekistan, when this has been tried before, how participatory were the people who were the subject of these attacks?
Yeah. For the first question, you know, did I see Russia coming? I mean, yes, I saw it as a threat. I saw it as a underrated threat, particularly, you know, after they took Crimea. And I was also interested in how Russia was using the internet, because there is this idea that authoritarian states, you know, they censor, they restrict content. And I was watching how they left the internet open, basically to confuse people, to bombard them with propaganda and conspiracy theories and lies, to the point that they gave up on the pursuit of truth altogether. And that's very much in the vein of what Trump did. And I don't think he needed Russian inspiration for that. I think that's just kind of how he operates on his own. You know, what I didn't see coming, I think, were the mafia connections, the extent of criminal ties between Trump, and I wouldn't even call them Russian actors exactly. It's a transnational crime syndicate that includes, you know, people from around the world, you know, just with a lot of heavy Russian involvement linked to the Kremlin, you know, these lines between who is a in the Kremlin, who is an oligarch, who is an organized crime. Those are all blurred. You know, it's a kind of apparatus that acts as one, and that Trump and his family and his company has been engaged with, you know, for decades. And so once I started looking into that, and of course, once Paul Manafort joined the campaign, I was deeply alarmed. And my question was, you know, and still remains, why didn't the FBI didn't do anything? Like, why didn't the CIA do anything? Like, it was like a million red flags that nobody was heeding. And I'm still wondering, like, how do you let a guy like this near national security issues? Like, how do you even let him, or Manafort for that matter, get close to White House power? So yeah, and in terms of Uzbekistan, you know, that's not the greatest comparison, because they've always been an authoritarian state, whether in the Soviet Union or after, you know, completely different history of democracy and sets of expectations. I think countries like Russia, you know, countries that are partially open in terms of their internet and media and their politics, although increasingly closed, are a better example, because you could watch that pattern of consolidation and of manipulation at play, and you can, you know, see a lot of the same dangers and the same warning signs happening here.
Now, I want to mention something as far as what you just said with regard to, you know, how the intelligence community, how the FBI approached the Russian attack prior to it really becoming public and the full extent of the attack being known. Did part of Russia's strategy here involve exploiting the abnormality of something like this, insofar as if it actually occurred? I just imagine the planning phase of, OK, so we're going to get the GRU to hack a bunch of things, and then we're going to have the Internet Research Agency do this entire propaganda push on social media and so on. And the rest is history. Did that process involve knowing that the American government would not know how to handle something like this, because it had never happened before, and therefore they could kind of get away with it, because the concern would be, as it turned out, one of politics? Like, does the sitting Democratic president really start to lean on the alarm bells with regard to an opposition party candidate running for president and getting help from Russia? So the inability for the government to react at that point in time because of politics, is that something that Russia really exploited?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, they studied very carefully how our system worked, what its weaknesses were, which people they could exploit, how our media economy works. I think they studied that particularly closely. You know, I think they had a couple of advantages. You know, one was complicity within the GOP, probably within the FBI. There's still some unexplained behavior on James Comey's part. So I don't think everyone was unwitting. There were witting actors, but then there were weaknesses. And I think, you know, Obama's style of management, you know, where he wanted things to be bipartisan. He didn't want to get confrontational. You know, when Mitch McConnell would undermine his presidency, obstruct his presidency, he always wanted to kind of take the high road. That's an extremely ineffective way of dealing with Russia. And I do have questions about not just Obama as an individual, but about the whole administration and why they didn't take this threat more seriously. Because by 2016, you know, Russia had hacked the DOD, the State Department, the DNC, the RNC, voter rolls, the electric grid, like really long list of hacking. We knew basically that WikiLeaks had become a front for Russian intelligence, even though it might not have started out that way. Like, you know, Hillary Clinton talked about this openly during her campaign. She released videos about it. So it's not like this was a secret. This is something they all knew about. And they seemed to just be placing their bets on, oh, he's not going to win. Hillary will win, and then we'll just, you know, it'll be cool. We'll work it out, which in itself is nuts. But it's also like really clueless about Trump's odds of winning. You know, one, because Trump did have some popular support, but also when you put this much effort into a plan, like when you put, you know, this is like Trump's fifth time of either running for president or almost running for president, you know, all these other operatives, people like Stone, Manafort, they've been in this for 30 years. Putin is like someone who always has a very long-term plans. When they're all planning something, you have to kind of consider, but what if they win? I mean, like, what if they pull it off? Like, what are you going to do then? And it's like no one considered that. And they keep making these same errors that are like rookie errors. You know, things like William Barr, everyone's like acting shocked by the way he's behaving. It's like, have you met this guy? Like, go to Wikipedia, like, read about Iran-Contra, read the memo he wrote against the Mueller probe. Like, you don't need to be in the FBI to know this. You just need, like, you know, a internet connection or a library card and some common sense. So I am confused as to why, I guess, people weren't more aware of their own weaknesses and how a hostile foreign power could exploit them.
It seems to me as if abnormal is taking advantage of normal. I think the party divide in all of this, I think partially the reason why Obama didn't take a harder line on the Russian attack as it was happening, especially as you get into late summer of 2016 or so, is because he was still relying on all things being normal, while at the same time, Donald Trump and certainly Vladimir Putin and Russia were playing a highly abnormal game. It was almost like a constant sucker punch that you're just not ready for it. And Obama's in the ring and he's kind of defending himself in the normal way. And they're using like a bazooka or something. They've brought heavy weaponry into the boxing ring. And Obama's going, I don't know what to do about this now. It seems to me as if that's really why more action wasn't taken. And I don't want to say here that Obama didn't do anything, because certainly he tried to do a few things. He certainly spoke to Vladimir Putin while all of that was going on. But at the same time, he didn't do enough. And I get the sense that there's almost like an epidemic of that, not only circulating through the Democratic Party. I also get the sense that Robert Mueller was playing a normal game in abnormal times. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been saying on our show on Gaslit Nation, you can't go buy the book when the book is burning. And that's what's been happening. You know, basically, it's kind of extended to how the general public has reacted. You know, people had normalcy bias, like that's what I've been calling it, throughout the campaign, where they would hear these stories about what Trump was up to with Russia. And, you know, even journalists would often dismiss them as hyperbole or as fantasy, because they thought, you know, if this is really happening, like if we really are having the presidency grasped by a hostile foreign power from the inside, like clearly the FBI or the CIA or Obama would do something about it. They would protect the country. You know, they would take steps to prevent it. And they didn't. And that's really shameful. And I do think that there is this kind of idea, you know, certainly in Obama's mind that, you know, things will just work out, you know, the checks and balances will hold, that the Republican Party somehow will behave itself or not stoop to this level. But what bothers me is that, you know, the behavior of Trump, you know, and all of his backers, Russian, American, and otherwise, it seems abnormal if you're expecting a functional democracy, but it's extremely normal for Trump. I mean, this is like a 40-year pattern of behavior going back to, you know, his work with Roy Cohn, you know, and we saw stuff like that, like during Watergate, we saw these Republicans behaving this way during Iran-Contra, during the financial crisis, in the lead up to the war with Iraq. And it's certainly, it is absolutely how Putin operates. He did the same thing, basically, in Ukraine with people like Manafort helping him. And so when you have the same people over and over again, and you have these partnerships that are documented in the public domain, and I would hope that in addition to the public domain information, you know, our agencies know more than I do and would prepare, you think they would take dramatic action. I mean, I think you should have held a press conference. I think, you know, possibly they should have delayed the election. I don't know. I mean, to me, it seems incredibly urgent. And the only reason I didn't think it was even more urgent than it was is because they weren't doing anything. And I think a lot of people looked at it that way. They thought, well, this can't be that consequential. Maybe I can sit this election out because I don't like either of these candidates. And they didn't know the stakes. And that bothers me a lot because I think you should always err on the side of caution if you're a public official, because your job is to protect the country.
Yeah. It seems like there's quite a dividing line between the public urgency, and I'm talking about those of us who have been following this story from the beginning and know all of the granular detail as it flies on by, as opposed to people who are only casually following politics. It seems to me as if those of us who have been following it have really been leaning on the panic button, and there's just a gigantic divide between us and our leadership, which seems like while they are taking a harder approach, and certainly there have been some admirable decisions and choices made by Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and some others, at the same time, I don't feel like it's enough. I don't feel like enough is being done given the gravity of the situation. I mean, the harrowing dangers and the peril that we face, not only in terms of the Russian attack, but in terms of how it's being handled politically on the ground here. And that's a big part of it. I mean, do you see the political reaction as being an integral part of this crisis in a negative sense, where it just doesn't seem like anyone's taking it seriously, or at least to the level they should?
Yeah, it's very disturbing to me. You know, I've seen this as a crisis since 2016. And, you know, since 2017, basically, like within weeks of Trump taking office, they had grounds to call for impeachment, you know, not just because of the Russia case, but because of emoluments, and then later the abuse of the pardon power, the abuse of migrants, you know, in illegal containment practices, like all these things. And they have refused to do this. And they kind of, you know, the Democrats lean on this excuse of, oh, we don't have, and you know, the House, we don't have the Senate. But, you know, once you get back the House, like, that is when you need to take urgent action, because this isn't like a partisan dispute, and this isn't an abstract matter. You know, there are lives on the line. And one of the things that I find very frustrating is the Democrats will say, oh, we can't focus on, you know, Trump and Russia. We need to look at domestic policy. And I'm like, those are the same things. Like, if this government controls everything, you know, if the GOP is trying to be a one-party autocratic state, then that has dire consequences in terms of things like healthcare, the environment, immigration, the treatment of migrants, the rollback of civil rights, the rollback of voting rights. And if you roll back those things, then you don't get a second chance. You know, you don't get to, like, you know, work it out in 2024. You have the country effectively over. And that's the juncture that I believe we're at. And I think that they should be acting with the utmost urgency and with utter transparency. Like, they need to present the stakes of the situation to the American people, even if it's frightening, because people need to know the truth. You know, they need to prepare for what may happen, and they need to know what rights are in jeopardy so that they can fight for those rights themselves. And, you know, they either sugarcoat the situation until they just can't anymore. That's in part because Trump is so blatant about what he's doing. He just, like, runs around confessing all his crimes on Twitter and on television and, you know, in bars, very flagrant as well. They all kind of get off on this. So it's become harder for them to play down how abnormal things are and how dangerous things are, but they're not taking actual steps to remedy them, the most obvious of which would be impeachment, in terms of hearings to inform the public, and in terms of, you know, potentially legal consequences. And yeah, you know, you asked about Mueller. I think Mueller ran a pretty bad probe. You know, he did not indict people who very obviously should have been indicted, like mm-hmm. Jared Kushner,
yep.
people who've committed crimes openly and are active ongoing threats. He didn't allow the judge to sentence Flynn, even though Flynn is a danger to public safety. Like, I was frustrated with this probe before the report came out.
Mm-hmm.
Then Barr comes out, lies about the contents of the report, and Mueller doesn't say anything for like a month until last night when he finally, you know, releases
yeah.
the letter. It's like, you know, what are you thinking? Like, whose side are you on? The side of democracy or the side of a mafia syndicate? Because quite honestly, he looks, you know, like an abettor of a mafia syndicate, and that's not what you want in a special counsel.
Yeah, you know what? I couldn't agree more. I just wrote a Salon piece about that exact thing, that I don't think Mueller was acting strong enough given the nature of the threat. Like, was there an anachronistic kind of investigation? It was an investigation that was more indicative of an investigation of George H.W. Bush rather than Donald Trump, for example, just throwing out Bush as an example there. And so what ended up happening was, once again, we see this conflict between Robert Mueller playing a normal game and everyone he's investigating playing a deeply abnormal game. And why wasn't there a rising to that occasion that took place in the context of that investigation, certainly in the context of the report that was issued? But before we get into Mueller in more detail, because I definitely have some more to say about him, I want to go back to something you were mentioning about all of these other things that could end up turning into, or should end up turning into, impeachment articles that are somehow effective getting steamrolled in as everyone pays attention to Russia. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't pay attention. Absolutely. The Russian attack is maybe the number one issue that we should be paying attention to right now. But at the same time, it seems like Donald Trump is kind of hiding behind the flooding of the zone, where there's such a catastrophic series of crimes here related to the election and ongoing attacks on our sovereignty. But at the same time, there's all these other things that aren't getting the attention they deserve. How do we square that? Because it seems to me, is at least Donald Trump, there ought to be an article of impeachment about Donald Trump's threat to withhold relief money for Puerto Rico just because the mayor of San Juan was mean to him. You know, it just seems like that should be an article of impeachment, but we're barely even through the things linked to Russia. How do we balance all of that out, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating. I don't buy the excuses that it's, you know, too much for the Democrats to do. It's like, if you and I, as just ordinary people, are able to keep all of these issues in our head and also connect them and
yeah.
see how, you know, if you don't do anything about one, you're going to have a worse version of the other. They should be able to do that as well. And it's their job. You know, and I also think we've seen some failure, generally speaking, by the media to emphasize certain issues. You know, the fact that Puerto Rico has basically disappeared off the radar
yeah.
for the last, you know, year and a half is an indication of that. You know, same with things that were once thought to be groundbreaking events like the Helsinki made up with Putin last year. Charlottesville sort of comes and goes to the public consciousness. And some of this is, you know, a result of so many atrocities happening simultaneously. But that's not an excuse for a lawmaker to therefore ignore atrocities. If anything, that's an indication that impeachment is desperately needed, because those atrocities are just going to continue to multiply as they consolidate power, and you're going to lose the ability to pursue them and stop them on legal grounds. You know, as all this is happening, Trump, or really, you know, the GOP apparatus, is packing the courts. They're purging agencies. They're taking out all of, you know, the vectors of accountability, basically, and, you know, making it impossible to pursue this in the future. And that's part of the strategy. Another part is running out the clock, knowing there's a statute of limitations, knowing mm-hmm. that people, you know, get exhausted over time. I mean, this is such a textbook, you know, how to build an autocracy. And the Democrats and others still have a shot at trying, you know, I don't know if they can completely reverse it, but they could at least slow it down. They can at least expose it to the public. And people like Pelosi, you know, they just won't take that shot. You know, there are some Democrats, you know, who've been very vocal about this, you know, Maxine Waters in particular, but on the whole, they're behaving either in a cowardly way or a complicit way or just in a clueless way. And none of those are good, you know, in this time of urgency. They really need to get their act together.
Yeah. And, you know, why didn't Mueller offer a recommendation to either Barr or Congress with regard to charges on the very least obstruction cases, at least 10 that were listed in the volume 2 of the report? Why wasn't he more explicit about what should be done from the issuance of the report forward, rather than kind of creating a nuanced argument along those lines where, you know, knowing that in this day and age, in 2019, for better or worse, nuance generally dies, especially when it enters the realm of the internet. Why do you think he wasn't more clear about those things?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think he should be asked that under oath. I think he should have to testify to Congress. And I think people should stop coddling Mueller or treating him like he's the savior. You know, they either treat him like he's this innocent little child, like, oh, how is he supposed to know what Barr would do or what people like to put up this institutionalist image, like, oh, you know, Mueller, he's so by the book. He's just dotting the I's and crossing the T's. Like, the number of times I heard that, I'm like, well, you know, dot the I and cross the T on indict, because that's honestly the only word that really matters to the Trump camp. And so that's been frustrating. You know, he's either extremely inept as a prosecutor or he's potentially compromised. You know, it is on my mind that Mueller is somebody who was the head of the FBI from 2001 to 2013, when this crime syndicate really took hold and took power, to the extent that it was Mueller himself in a speech in 2011 that, you know, he gave a speech about it being, you know, the greatest danger essentially to humanity, how it was not some sort of abstract issue, how there's a new kind of organized crime inserting itself into corporations and governments that was going to profoundly impact our daily lives. He talked about rising prices. He talked about, you know, democracies becoming autocracies. He really seems to understand this issue, and he named specifically the head of the Russian mafia, you know, who Trump has been linked to for a very long time, as the biggest threat, and then did nothing about it. So it's hard to say that he's naive. He refused to act. Comey refused to act. Comey took that guy, Semyon Mogilevich, off the FBI's most wanted list for reasons that were never explained, right as Trump began to gain ground in his campaign in late 2015. And all that adds up to a really disturbing picture. And I don't know what that picture is. That's what I was hoping to learn from the Mueller report. But instead, the Mueller report was like, it's actually like press clippings. You know, it's all mostly materials that were in the public domain already and that I knew. And nothing new has been brought to the fore, which is why I think he needs to go under oath.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? On one hand, we're spending a lot of time indicting Bill Barr and Donald Trump for spinning the Mueller report and saying things about it that don't that aren't actually true, whether it's no obstruction or what have you, that Trump is completely exonerated, all of those things. But at the same time, while we're accusing them of lying about the report, shouldn't we say a few things about, I think I know your answer before you even give it, but shouldn't we be saying something about Robert Mueller and his vague language allowing that to happen? I mean, it seems like he didn't get the idea that he's dealing with a White House that will say and do anything to exonerate itself. And he kind of played right into that, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the minute that Barr released what Mueller is now confirming is an inaccurate summary, and of course we know it's inaccurate because we've seen the report, but a month went by in between those two things, he should have spoken out. He should have released a statement. He should have released his own summaries that he had prepared. I have no idea what the weakness is here that held him back. You know, people liked to make excuses for him. They said, oh, it's DOJ protocol. It's like, well, he's not working for the DOJ now. He's not part of that. He's a private citizen. He can say whatever he wants. And this is a time when he urgently needs to just tell the truth, you know, for the American public. That's why he was appointed as the special counsel. No. And he didn't do that. And it's hard for me to think he's that naive, because, of course, for the last month, he watched this play out. He watched initially a lot of people grab onto the Barr narrative. You know, that was the first one. That's the one that people will often remember. And, you know, then he watched the Mueller report come out, and a lot of people try to summarize that inaccurately. And he's remained completely quiet. And I'm sorry, like, that's not the act of a patriot. That's not the actions of someone who cares about the fate of his country. That's someone who seems pretty content to just let it go down so long as people like him, you know, white, wealthy Republican men, are not hurt. You know, that seems to be his priority. I don't understand, you know, of all the people in this horrific saga, he has more power than most, and he could use that power responsibly, you know, to serve his country, or he could just dodge out. And, you know, I don't understand why he's, you know, running from that responsibility, but that is what he's done.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And you know what? More of that is occurring now, because with the leak of this Mueller letter, the letter that Mueller wrote to William Barr that we saw come out in the Washington Post last night, that there's more conflicting language that leaves all kinds of wiggle room that we're seeing Bill Barr just sashay right through today in the Senate hearing. And what I'm speaking of specifically is the letter actually says the summary letter the department sent to Congress and released to the public late in the afternoon of March 24th did not fully capture the content, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusion. So we know that. But at the same time, we see this passage in the Washington Post piece. And we, by the way, we're seeing William Barr really exploiting that to his own advantage today. The passage goes, when Barr pressed Mueller on whether he thought Barr's memo to Congress was inaccurate, Mueller said he did not, but felt that the media coverage of it was misinterpreting the investigation, officials said. What do you make of that passage, Sarah?
I mean, you know, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, and both sides are saying bullshit. So, you know, it's kind of hard to square all that away. I think that, you know, Mueller allowed Barr an opening in the fact that he did not come out and immediately correct that report. Mm-hmm. Barr, you know, seems to allow Mueller a lot of leeway. Nobody is pushing for transparency. No one's describing what actually happened in forthright terms. All of this also kind of, you know, goes around the fact that the Mueller report, at least in my view, is not a very good report. Like, it's not very thorough. It's missing a lot of information. It, you know, he didn't interview a lot of key players. It omits the broader context, which Mueller, you know, as I mentioned, explored himself as head of the FBI, of the role of transnational mafias in government, and specifically Mogilevich, who Trump worked with. You know, you didn't do a good job, and we're all here kind of arguing and nitpicking about the particulars because what they put out was such an incredible lie. You know, this idea that Trump is exonerated, that Trump did not collude with Russia, you know, like that all of this is just something that people made up. I mean, that's just a flat lie. Mm-hmm. But underneath that is still, you know, a pretty lackluster, you know, investigative report, which does not, you know, exonerate Trump. It's not a lie per se. It's not high quality. And I kind of wonder, you know, what were they up to? And it's difficult for me to think that Mueller, you know, wasn't, I guess, you know, involved in this somehow, given that he is close friends with Barr, given that this is a social circle he's moved in for a long time. You know, people say, oh, he wasn't, he couldn't have possibly been complicit in this because he's such an upstanding citizen. And I'm like, he's not behaving like an upstanding citizen right now. So I don't know how to kind of, you know, put that together, you know, his reputation with his actions. You know, he's certainly not living up to this glorified reputation that they gave him. And the consequences, both for our country and for ordinary citizens, are enormous. And it's hard for me to believe he doesn't understand that.
Okay, we're going to continue with Sarah in just a second. But first, let's talk about Mother's Day, just 12 days away. And I'm all set with gifts for my mom, haha, thanks to ProFlowers.com. For about 7 years, I lived on the opposite end of the world. I lived in Hawaii and then California, thousands of miles from where my mom lives. So I desperately needed a convenient way to shower her with my appreciation on Mother's Day. ProFlowers was the perfect way to say Happy Mom's Day when I couldn't necessarily travel thousands of miles for the occasion. Oh, by the way, the other day I also bought my girlfriend and after-party co-host Kimberly Johnson a dozen multicolored roses from ProFlowers, and they arrived exactly when I wanted them to, and they both looked and smelled freshly cut direct from the farm and nourished by ProFlowers' innovative gel pack, and thanks to ProFlowers' express delivery. but they've got way more than just roses at ProFlowers. ProFlowers let you choose from a variety of bouquets and unique vases to suit any mom style. And right now, get this, with just 12 days to go, get a dozen roses for $19.99. Double the roses and get a premium vase for just $9.99 more. Visit ProFlowers.com, then click the microphone in the upper right corner. Enter the promo code BOBC. Again, promo code BOBC. That's ProFlowers.com. Click the microphone and enter BOBC. Mother's Day is May 12th, so don't wait. Order like a pro and get this amazing rose deal to thank all the moms in your life. Thank you for supporting the Bob Seska Show by supporting ProFlowers.com.
The Bob Seska Show.
How badly were we duped by our own expectations? I think in a lot of ways we superimposed a lot of superpowers onto Robert Mueller that he doesn't actually possess. You know, I always go back to the, I don't know if you remember the old Chuck Norris memes where they would just, it was like how great Chuck Norris is. Like Chuck Norris doesn't do push-ups, he pushes the earth down. Were we doing that with Robert Mueller? And then when we see the real Robert Mueller, we're blindsided. Is that kind of what happened, where the real Robert Mueller was the Mueller that was going to happen all along, and then we had this inflated idea of what was going to happen, what he was going to do. And so the real fault, and I'm just speaking hypothetically, the real fault is our overly hyped expectations. Is that what happened, or were, you know, was all of this anticipation about Mueller and his powers, was that all well placed?
I mean, I think it's a combination. Like, I personally did not share the high expectations for Mueller, basically because I was just tracking the probe, and I thought it was really poorly done. I thought it was too slow. I thought they weren't indicting people. I thought he was making weird plea deals with people like Manafort. So my expectations were low. You know, my partner, Andrea Chalupa on Gaslit Nation, we did an episode in October 2018 called Robert Mueller Will Not Save You. And we took an enormous amount of flack for daring to state that, but that was just based on the evidence we saw. And I do think, you know, there's far too much hype around him, but that hype is kind of revealing of the broader situation that we're in, that this seems to be the one way that they could actually take Trump and all of these criminals surrounding him down. You know, this was our only route because checks and balances had failed, you know, because Congress was not doing its job, because the FBI was not doing its job. So then it just boiled down to Mueller, and then Mueller didn't do his job. And you know, there's another part. What was the other part of the question?
Well, no, it was just about
beyond the hype.
Yeah. It was just about whether or not our expectations exceeded Robert Mueller's ability.
I remember what I was going to say. Like, even if Mueller had done a spectacular job, like even if he had written, you know, a very incriminating, detailed, contextualized report, this outcome with Barr and with Trump still would have happened, because they will do absolutely anything to not be indicted and to not be taken out of power, because if they're out of power, they're going to be held accountable. And this is also the culmination of, I think, you know, a multi-decade project by the GOP to basically transform the U.S., you know, into a one-party autocratic state. And I don't think it was always all of the GOP. I think the fringes became the center for that party over time. And they did it in tandem, you know, with Russian partners, and also, I think, with help from Israel, help from Saudi Arabia. You know, you're seeing the same names of people close to the Trump camp or close to others in the GOP coming up over and over again. So they would have done anything to negate the meaning of this report and to make sure it didn't have the only kind of consequences that matter to them, which are legal consequences. I mean, they need to be in jail. That's the only thing that's going to actually contain them. And even there, it doesn't really, like Manafort was still writing propaganda for Ukrainian newspapers while in jail. You know, so it doesn't always work, but that's the only thing that they understand is just, you know, force and legal consequences. They don't care about shame. They don't care about laws. They don't care about protocol. And that's what the Democrats and Mueller and others keep trying to turn to. It's not going to work for those particular high moving players, you know, in the Trump camp. It might work for, you know, it might have an impact on, I think, the general American public to see laws respected to see kind of our legal processes or processes of democracy going, which is another reason to have impeachment hearings.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they will do anything to win. And it doesn't matter what happens to the country or what happens to the people living in it.
Do you think Robert Mueller just gifted Donald Trump a pretext to not leave office in 2021? And what I mean by that is, obviously here, all of these obstruction charges in the Mueller report are charges that can be prosecuted once Trump leaves office. So knowing that, and knowing that Mueller didn't offer a prosecutorial recommendation in the report, at the very least to Congress, for God's sake, now Trump has got the impression that, well, when I leave office, I'm going to be prosecuted for obstruction of justice. Maybe I should think about doing everything necessary to not leave office in 2021, even if that means losing the election and just discrediting the whole thing and throwing all the whole thing into doubt. Whatever he chooses to do, however he chooses to do it. Do you think that this inadvertently gave him grounds upon which he can pursue that goal?
I think that was always Trump's goal. I think that was the goal basically from, you know, 2015, 2016 onward, because he needed to protect, you know, the ramifications of all his previous crimes,
yeah.
you know, for which he was never indicted, and for the crimes that he committed during the campaign, and now for the crimes that he's committed in office. And those also include the crimes of Ivanka and of Jared, who are maybe like the two people I think he would stick his neck out for. I actually don't think he would for Donald Jr. But, you know, so I think that this was already in his mind, and therefore, because it was very obvious, you know, we even saw Michael Cohen talking at his testimony about how Trump wasn't going to leave in 2020, it should have been on Mueller's mind. And yeah. Mueller should have written the language in a direct way so that Trump would not be able to use it for propaganda. And of course, you know, Trump will use anything for propaganda. If Mueller had said, you know, Trump is a career criminal who needs to be behind bars for the safety of the nation, you know, Trump would just say, witch hunt, witch hunt. He made it up. He's working for Soros. He's working for the Democrats. He'd just make up some nonsense thing. But still, you know, you don't want to give him that out when you're telling the truth. And, you know, a truthful statement would be Donald Trump needs to be, you know, imprisoned so that he's not able to harm our country and others, you know, and because he has committed crimes steadily for 40 years without punishment. I mean, that's not like my opinion. That's just a fact. And he wouldn't go that far. I mean, obviously, in legal language, you know, you do things differently. But still, I think he could have made a much stronger statement, and he shouldn't have given him anything extra to work with.
Should we be content with the idea that the Junior is probably going to go down with regard to the SDNY investigation rather than going down with regard to the Mueller report? I mean, many of us were frustrated that there was no indictment of Don Junior for the Trump Tower meeting and all the actions involved around that. Certainly the meeting with the Psy Group in August and so on. Seems to me as if there was enough cause to at least prosecute Don Jr. Nothing happened along those lines, but SDNY's got a shot at him with the you know, the financial crimes. So is that consolation enough, or should we be more irritated that that Mueller didn't get him?
Well, I'm irritated with Mueller, but I also don't have a lot of faith in SDNY. You know, they previously let Donald Jr. and Ivanka go before. They were supposed to be indicted for felony in 2012 because of their dealings with Trump Soho. And then Trump had his lawyer pay off the judge, Cy Vance, who is still the judge, you know, who will be looking at some of these cases. And from what I also understand, I believe Barr has some oversight in, you know, whether cases go to SDNY. Like, there's not this kind of, you know, independence of the courts that I think a lot of folks wish was there or assume is there. And then, of course, you have to consider that they're going to use the same tactics that they've done in all of the other cases. Like in Manafort's trial, they threatened the judge. They threatened the jury. That threatened judge came back later and said that Manafort, probably one of the worst people in this whole saga, and that's the thing a lot, and led an otherwise blameless life. Like, that's not a normal comment for a judge to ever make, and it's definitely not a normal comment to make about Manafort. And so my assumption is that judge was threatened. The other judge, in Roger Stone's case, Amy Berman Jackson, he threatened to kill her, you know, on the internet. And he's still out wandering around. He's still, you know, unpunished for that. He never followed up, even though he's obviously a danger. So what we're seeing is mafia tactics. You know, we're seeing mafia threats and mafia behavior. And I think we should expect to see those same tactics aimed at the SDNY. And, you know, I think this is one of the things that the Democrats don't want to talk to the public about, like, one, because it's very frightening, and two, because it raises the question of, well, how did everyone let this happen? Like, how do we have this level of institutional failure where we're seeing, you know, a mafia state arising in a very blunt and open way, like beyond our kind of standard level of corporate corruption, which has always been there, in the United States, and they'll have to be accountable for that. But I think that that's necessary. I think that we need complete transparency on this issue, or we're never going to be able to solve it.
Do you think that's why so many Republicans specifically and former administration officials are just bending over backwards to defend this guy? Is it the mafia tactics? I mean, what does Trump have on them that is causing all of these people to just, like, really stick their necks out beyond normal, you know, acquiescence to someone like this? Why are they doing that? It seems to me as if he's just too toxic to defend, to link your name to, but yet everyone's still doing it anyway. I don't understand why that is. What do you think?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And, you know, this is another example of mafia tactics being very similar, you know, to autocratic tactics. And in states like Russia or Uzbekistan, you really see like a conglomeration of both. And now we're seeing that in the U.S. You know, and so in terms of why the Republicans turned into such sycophants for Trump, I think initially there was some careerism, some opportunism. I think a lot of these guys are just dirty, you know, so you can have that. You can be a, you know, a bad actor and simultaneously be threatened, be blackmailed, be bribed. I do think, you know, those are the standard tactics that the Trump camp has used on everyone for 40 years. I don't know why they would have stopped using them on the Republican Party, especially because through Stone and Manafort and others who are, you know, heavily involved as GOP operatives, they have dirt on all of these members of the Republican Party, particularly, you know, older people who've been around for a while. I think there's that. I sometimes wonder about the existence of broader external threats, because we have had all these instances of hacking, including hacking of the infrastructure. And we've seen, you know, Russia carry out these kind of tactics in Ukraine, you know, where they brought down their grid. And there was mention of this by some Republicans, including John McCain before he died, repeatedly, you know, that Russia is threatening to, you know, collapse U.S., you know, grid infrastructure. So I sometimes wonder if that's a threat holding in check not just the Republicans, but the Democrats. In terms of the GOP specifically, you know, one thing that tends to happen when a democracy turns into an autocracy is people will put up a fight at first. You know, you kind of saw this with like Lindsey Graham, for example. Mm-hmm. And over time, you know, however they're compromised, whether it's because of dirty money, whether it's because of something in their own life that they don't want revealed, whether it's because they're threatened, they sort of embrace the position they're in because they need, you know, psychologically to justify it. You know, they can't live the rest of their life feeling as if they're not in control, feeling as if they lack any kind of personal power. And so I think that this kind of ostentatious display of loyalty and attack on the Democrats from people like Graham is a way for him to just reinvent himself as an autocratic lackey and to just kind of inhabit that persona fully so that it doesn't seem like he's just like Trump's bitch. You know? Yeah. Like, I think he needs to have a sense of autonomy in this situation. And that's gross, and it's unfortunate for all of us, but it's a pretty typical reaction when people become implicated in this kind of criminal plot or into a burgeoning autocratic state.
Yeah, yeah. Why do you think Donald Trump is suing Deutsche Bank and Capital One over the congressional subpoena, but not Letitia James's subpoena of Deutsche Bank and Capital One?
I'm not exactly sure about the difference between them. I mean, generally speaking, excessive litigation has been a tactic that Trump has used going back to the 70s. You know, when he worked with Roy Cohn, he continued it with Michael Cohen. A lot of it is buying time. You know, that's their greatest asset, which is one of the reasons I was mad that Mueller went so slowly, is they just run out the clock and they consolidate power and they pack courts and they purge agencies and they get players in place that will do their bidding and get rid of the people that they find irritating. I'm wondering if they find Tish James to be too annoying at this point to be an actual threat for them, and they're trying to figure out how to get rid of her. You know, they got rid of Schneiderman. They got rid of Elliot Spitzer, Roger Stone. I mean, Elliot Spitzer brought this upon himself, as did Eric Schneiderman. But, you know, they dug up that dirt on them, and they used it when it was most opportune. And so I don't know if they have dirt on Tish James and they're just waiting for the right time, or they don't have anything on her and they're trying to figure out a way to get rid of her. Because so far, at least to me, she seems like, you know, a good faith actor who maybe will try to bring some of these charges and have some actual results. But it's hard to tell. It is interesting that they've not yet sued her, although I wouldn't be surprised if they do.
Well, that's a really good point. They just haven't deployed against her yet. Like, they're just waiting. They've got a plan in place, maybe, or they're working on a plan, and they'll eventually unleash it at some point of their choosing, rather than doing everything at the same time. Maybe it's that, right?
That's one of the biggest misconceptions about these guys. Like, everyone gets this wrong. They look at Trump, and they just see this, like, blithering moron, which, okay, fine.
Yeah.
But, like, he surrounds himself with people who are really good at navigating bureaucracy, at committing crimes and getting away with it, at orchestrating propaganda, managing the media, and they lie in wait. People like Roger Stone, you know, who seem like these kind of flamboyant, nonsensical men, are very good at long-term planning and, you know, and thinking of it like a chess player, getting the pieces ready. I mean, everyone says, oh, Mueller, he was playing chess. It's like, you know, Mueller wasn't playing chess at all. These guys actually are. They have a lot invested in this, and they're not just going to, you know, let it go down. And so that's part of the problem, you know, is that they're not taken as seriously as they should be. I mean, I think they are now because of all that's come to pass, you know, with Trump as president and the loss of our rights and all these other things. But initially, they weren't, because of their personas, and that was to their advantage. And I think they knew that, too.
Yeah. Just a couple more questions for you, Sarah, and I'll let you get back to the hearings. But if you were a member of the House Judiciary Committee, we just heard today that Mueller's definitely going to be testifying sometime this month, according to Jerry Nadler. What's the first thing you would ask Robert Mueller during his forthcoming testimony?
Oh, God. Well, if I knew, you know, America was going to be tuning in, I would ask why he allowed Barr to misrepresent his work for a month before speaking out, and then pivot to the work itself. And, you know, one thing I would want to ask him is, I would bring up that 2011 speech, you know, where he laid out this threat of organized crime being interwoven into government, which basically seemed to define people like Trump and Manafort, and say, you know, if you know all this, like, how do you connect this to what you've found today? And just let him talk and see, you know, where that goes. Because that, to me, is one of the key things, is that he was aware of what these people were like, down to their names, and didn't do anything about it.
Yeah. What are Greenwald and Taibbi up to right now? They both have this history of attacking powerful men and women at the highest levels of government. So why are they so vigorously defending Trump on this? What do you think about that?
I have no idea. You know, Greenwald, you know, he just doesn't seem tethered to reality. Yeah. I think, you know, they both have somewhat of a sunk cost fallacy thing going on, where they were so adamant that there was no, you know, illicit relationships with Russia, that they want badly for that to be proven correct, which I think is bizarre. I mean, of course, we would all like for there to be no illicit relationships with Russia, but it's very blatant. And what interests me, especially about Taibbi, is that, you know, their traditional work has targeted powerful politicians and corporations. And this, to me, basically is a matter of kleptocracy and a matter of white crime / organized crime, and where those lines blur. You would think that would be a topic that they'd not just be engaged in, but would want, you know, to bring transparency to, you know, for the benefit of ordinary people who end up getting badly hurt by these kind of criminal syndicates / corporations / governments. And they seem completely, you know, unsympathetic to the incredible damage that this administration and all of its lackeys are doing. And so I think there's a real failure of empathy and a real failure of understanding on their part.
And, you know, Matt Taibbi spent a lot of time in Russia doing a lot of writing and doing a lot of drugs. This is just what he's written about. So I'm not, like, saying anything out of school or making any accusations that are unfounded. He's written extensively about his time in Russia. I think that could be partly it. I mean, there could be some sort of connection there. As far as Greenwald goes, I have this ongoing theory, and it goes back to Edward Snowden. And I'm not sure exactly if there's connection between the Snowden story and what's happened with Russia since then, because one was sort of pre-2014 and the other is post-2014, and 2014 being a pivot point, I think, for Russia and the United States posture against Russia. But at the same time, Glenn Greenwald spent a lot of time defending Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden is now a welcome guest of Vladimir Putin, and Edward Snowden also happens to be Glenn Greenwald's main source, like his guy that he seems to have a connection with and needs to protect. Do you think that might have something to do with it?
Oh, I suspect it does. I mean, Snowden was Greenwald's meal ticket, and then he was someone who Greenwald adamantly defended and kept saying, you know, no, it's just a coincidence that he touched down in Russia with all of this classified information from the United States. I mean, I think, you know, Greenwald, of course, and Snowden in particular, need to be reevaluated in the context of everything that's happened since, you know, the same way that Assange and WikiLeaks have been reevaluated. And a lot of people who initially worked with or supported Assange and WikiLeaks have now said, you know, I regretted that. I was misled. Like, I was duped. I ended up accidentally spreading Russian propaganda and helping a criminal espionage operation, and I didn't even know it. Like, I think that there's an unwillingness on Greenwald's part, if that's the case, if he was just truly duped, to come forward and admit it. And if it's something worse, maybe he doesn't want to be investigated. You know, he may just be fearful of that. I think it's in the best interest of everyone to, you know, just come clean because of the broader threat that this administration and all of its apparatus pose, you know, to journalists, to ordinary citizens. You know, Greenwald often speaks out about human rights, you know, for example, the rights of Muslims and, you know, other targets of religious persecution in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Here's an administration that's targeting them. Like, you'd think you'd want to, you know, stop that and use whatever powers you had to do so. But everything Greenwald has done recently has just helped Trump, helped streamline this narrative. So, yeah, I don't understand why he's doing that, since, of course, the narrative Greenwald puts out contradicts objective truth.
Seems to me as if his drive to scold Democrats is greater than his drive to actually pursue what's right and sort of his actual personal politics, which are decidedly somewhat liberal, but sort of somewhere on that horseshoe diagram where they kind of meet up with some crazies on the far right, too. So seems very strange to me. And of course, the Edward Snowden story has a lot of the same players. Edward Snowden spending some time at the Russian consulate in Hong Kong and then getting chauffeured to Moscow by WikiLeaks lawyers. Seems like there are some things there that you could focus on as having some sort of connection to the overall Russian attack after that. So, but Sarah, I really appreciate your time, and it's a hugely busy day. Lots of news breaking at this point in time. But I really appreciate you coming on the show and joining me today to talk about all this stuff.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, good luck with Gaslit Nation, and tell Andrea I said hi.
Okay, thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.